For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, this story starts in John 4, verse 1, where we read the Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John the Baptist, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord heard of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. The sense of it is that there was jealousy that's mentioned later in the gospel as one of the main motives in the death of Jesus was the jealousy people felt because everyone listened to him. So he felt the heat rising in Judea, and he got out of there to go back up to the north to Galilee. And we read in verse 4, now he had to go through Samaria. Well, it's a strange comment. It sticks out in this narrative. This is Israel back in the days of Jesus. The southern part down here where Jerusalem is Judea. The northern part's called Galilee. You see Nazareth up there. In between, this area is Samaria. So it might seem like, yeah, you have to go through Samaria to get to Galilee. But in fact, most people didn't go that way. The usual way, the way Jesus had just come, was down the Jordan Valley or up the Jordan Valley, and then there was a road from Jordan up to Jerusalem, up on the ridge. The reason they didn't go through Samaria is because of the hostility between Jews and Samaritans, which as we'll see in this account tonight was pretty intense. It was actually kind of dangerous to go through there. You could get jumped. You could have people throwing stones at you. These guys had fought wars with each other. You don't just go walking into somebody else's country. The Romans would go through there. They weren't worried about it. But Jews had to be, they also felt that Samaritan people were unclean and that anything they touched or used was unclean. So how would you have dinner? How would you get food during a journey through Samaria when anything you bought would be unclean? They didn't like to go there for that reason. And also, it's a mountainous area, so the route is very circuitous. It's actually just as long to go through and a lot more climbing to go through Samaria as it would to go over the well-built Roman road right up the Jordan Valley. So, for all of these reasons, the usual route from Galilee to Judea was up the Jordan. But John says Jesus had to go through Samaria. Why did he have to go through there? It's because he had an appointment that he wanted to be sure not to miss. Appointment with this lady. It wasn't an accident. He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. This well is one of the most guaranteed authentic sites in Israel. When you go to Israel, they'll often tell you, you know, this is the traditional birthplace of Jesus, or this is the traditional place of his tomb and stuff like that. All of them are guesswork. We don't really know whether any of them are authentic. It's somewhere around there. Not this one. This well has been in continual use for 3,000 or 4,000 years. This is a cutaway of it. We read down in verse 9. She says, this well is deep. It is deep. I was actually looking forward to seeing this well. Here it is in 1900. Because this is known to be an authentic site. Really to sit right where Jesus sat. And I wanted to look up at the town and see if I had it right the way I had imagined this story and stuff. Well, when we got there, like so many of these sites, almost all of them, in Israel now, there's this huge, gross church built right over the well. This is what it looks like now. And, you know, those stairways on either side of the altar go down into a basement where the well is. So you can't see the city anymore from the well, and it's just really messed up. There's all these icons and creepy incense hanging all over it and everything. They sell the water. They put it in little vials and sell it as holy water that heals. And so, typical Xenos, one of our people, one of our guys goes up and looks, and you know, you look down there. I don't know, I would say I'd put it maybe 80 feet deep. It's pretty deep. I don't even know how they dug these kind of wells, because it's not very big around either. How do you get a guy down there to dig 80 feet down? Anyway, our guy just walks up and he's like, huh? You know, hock de loogie down in there. Those priests went insane. They just, oh! They just bustled us all out. They were pissed. He's like, what? What? The profane meets the sacred. Anyway, it's one of these little marks that the author of this book is from Judea. He knows the area, he knows Palestine. And he knew this well. He was there with Jesus on this trip. Contrary to the liberal theory that we don't hear much of anymore, that John was written 150 years after the fact by the Johannine school up in Greece, people that have never even seen the Holy Land, this author has been there. And this story is authentic. It is about the sixth hour. That's noon. That's the middle of the day. The first hour is sunrise. Well, so this is the heat of the day when people, you know, take their siesta or stay out of the sun in the Middle East. And yet here comes this woman bopping down there. We read a Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus says to her, will you give me a drink? Because he had sent his disciples up into the town to get food. Okay, so what's wrong with this picture? First of all, we know the customs of the time. The women in a village had to draw water. They would do, this was a social event. They would come down together. It's done in the morning. And then some of them would have to come back again in the evening. This woman comes down without the other women. She comes down not at the sunrise when they come. She comes in the middle of the day, in the heat of the day, all by herself. Something wrong with that picture. And we'll see as the story develops why this is. She's a reject. She, particularly among the women probably in town, she's had 5 different husbands. She's living with a man that she's not married to. That was, so bad in this culture, and not just the Jews. Samaritans felt the same way. This woman would be considered a lowlife, a tramp, a slut, and she was rejected. So last week we were talking about this man of great honor, this holy man, this wealthy, powerful, respected rabbi comes to Jesus. Here we've gone about as far away from that as you can get. She is rejected by her own people. And the Samaritan woman then says to him, you are a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? And John explains, for Jews do not associate with Samaritans. They certainly don't talk to them. This business of being a Samaritan. Samaritans were a people who were part Jewish, and then at the time that the Assyrians had destroyed the top half of Israel, they had deported the people of the northern half and then imported captives from other countries to live in this area, and so they had kind of intermixed. And they had come up with a religion that was similar to Judaism in a lot of ways, but they did not accept most of the Old Testament. They only accepted the first 5 books as scripture. When the southern part of Judea was driven out later by the Babylonians and taken into exile, these were the only guys left behind for a long time. Then those got to come back the Judea got to come back. And when they came back, that's written up for us in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And they had to rebuild their city and their temple and so forth. In the book of Nehemiah, you have the figure Sanballat, who tries to block them from building their stuff. Him and his people send messengers back to the Persians to get a block, and they're barred from further building, and convince the Persians that the Jews are formulating a revolt against them. Sanballat is a Samaritan. His people are Samaritans. This hostility went all the way back that far. Subsequent to that, the Samaritans had sent a war party down to attack the temple in Jerusalem. The Jews sent a war party. Then they built their own temple on Mount Gerizim, which is in Samaria. Said, this is where the temple really belongs. And the Jews had sent a war party up to tear that down and had been driven off. So they had fought these wars against each other. At this point, under the Romans, there were just icy silence and completely frozen out from each other. In John 8, you get a feeling for this when the Jews, these are Jesus' enemies, answered and said to him, do we not say rightly that you're a Samaritan and you have a demon? And that was like a 24-karat insult of that day. It's like, which is worse, being demon-possessed or a Samaritan? Kind of, you know, take your pick. In Luke 9, Jesus sent messengers ahead to a Samaritan village trying to set up a place to stay for the night, and the people of the village did not welcome Jesus. When James and John saw this, they said to Jesus, should we call down fire from heaven to burn them up? You can just tell they're just like, bastards! Flame them! Let's get them! And so they were known after this as the Sons of Thunder, because they were so bloodthirsty in their desire to destroy the Samaritans. Anyway, the hostility between these was very real. Also, she's a woman in a day when, you know, women were just not given the respect that they should have been. This was a highly patriarchal culture. And women were viewed as the inferior sex, the weak sex. We read in the Talmud that it's better to get a man's kindness than a woman's goodness. It's woman who brings shame and disgrace. That's called misogyny, hatred of women in religion, real common in rabbinic Judaism. They taught that it would be better to burn the law, the scriptures, than to let them fall into the hands of a woman. They would not educate women. Women were to stay home and shut up. Rabbis did not speak to women in public. Professor Keener points out, thus among the six activities listed as unbecoming for a scholar, one is conversing with a woman. And in theory, the strict gave the opinion that a wife could be divorced without her marriage settlement if she spoke to a man in the street. Still true in some Middle Eastern countries today. A woman could be killed if she's seen talking to a man that's not her husband. That's the way it was. Now, Jesus didn't believe in any of this, as we see in this story. He just blasts right through all of these prejudices and just starts this conversation, you know, with this woman. And in fact, is going to spend time with this town and the Samaritans there. Well, Jesus answered her. This is her comment. How come you're talking? Why are you talking to me? I wonder if she thought he was hitting on her. It's possible. But definitely, she is rocked. She's just like, you're a Jew, you're a rabbi, and you're a man, and yet you're here talking to me. How can this be? Jesus answers her this, very intriguing. If you knew the gift of God, and if you knew who it is that asked you to give a drink, you would have asked him, you would have asked me, and he would have given you living water. About that, living water. So there's two things you have to know in this, according to Jesus. the gift of God and who it is that's speaking to you. It's the person and the work of Jesus. The person of Jesus. Who is he? Everything depends on that. If he was just an ancient guy with a few ideas, intriguing ideas, you know, this would be small change. But when we learn, as he says straight up later in this story, I am the Messiah, that's a whole different look. Now we understand it, realize he's the Son of God. He's come here. He's put on humanity. He is the promised Messiah from the Old Testament. And we need to know that, because otherwise, why would we think he has anything special to offer? And of course, the gift of God is what we were studying last week, if you were here, when Jesus said, for God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that whosoever believes in him would not perish, but have everlasting life. The gift of God is nothing less than complete forgiveness for every sin you ever have or ever will commit. And a personal guarantee of God that you'll have eternal life free of charge. That's a gift, all right. And so Jesus is like, there is an opportunity here that you don't really understand. I could give you something that we could call living water. He's asked her for some water. He says, I got some water for you. In the Near East, it's a semi-arid area. Water's pretty important. People get thirsty, can't always go to the nearest water fountain. And so Jesus kind of picks up on that here in this, and he's kind of talking about something called an inner thirst that people have. And as they go on in the conversation, this living water, he goes on to explain it later. I'll just wait till then. Sir, the woman said, you don't even have anything to draw with. This well is deep. That's where she says it's deep. Where are you going to get this living water? You're not greater than our father Jacob, are you? He gave us this well and drank of it himself and his sons and his cattle. I take it she's probably got a little bit of an edge on here. Kind of, oh, that's great. You're going to give me living water. You don't even have a bucket. You must think you're really something. You know, probably when we get the bio on this gal and realize she's been used and discarded repeatedly through her life, you know, people in that situation tend to develop a tough exterior. And that's the way I read this interchange, is that she's being sarcastic here to Christ, as you would expect from someone like that. And Jesus busts out and says, yeah, everyone that drinks this water is going to be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. The water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Well, so it is this gift that he mentioned. It is the same one as last week, isn't it? It's eternal life. And so here is this inner thirst that we all have. Every one of us, although we may suppress it in various ways, try to cover it over with success, experience, drugs, booze, inside is this lingering sense that something is missing, that there must be more, that I wonder, what I'm here for, who am I? What is my life about? We don't have answers to these questions. And it creates this sense of thirst. I'm thirsty. We think to ourselves, yeah, I have this longing for something. And then we try to say, oh, well, more money would probably satisfy it, or a nicer car, some more clothes, or, you know, whatever we like to put in that space and longing, a nice sex affair, that'd probably make it feel better. And none of them fill it. We all get thirsty again every time. He says, I can give you the thing that you take this and you'll never thirst. It will finally slake that continual thirst that galls us all the time. The woman says, "Sir, give me this water." Oh man, she's responsive. She wants it. So that I don't have to get thirsty and keep coming here to draw water. Oh. No, she's not responsive. She's probably still sarcastic. Oh, great. I want it to come out here. Yeah, bring it. She's not thinking. She's not taking him seriously. I don't think she's this dense that she can't pick up the metaphor. I think it's that she's kind of scoffing at it. And so we have a surprise turn in the story all of a sudden. Jesus says, "Go call your husband and come back." Whoa. Well, I guess it's okay to change the subject once in a while, but this has nothing to do. What does this have to do with this water discussion? We see when she comes back and says, "Yeah, I don't even have a husband," she replied. Jesus says, "Yeah, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had 5 husbands, and the man you now live with is not your husband." So it is accurate, I guess. Can you imagine being her in this situation? And he just described your past history, probably the sorest spot in her life. This. Think of that. What an extreme case this was. 5 husbands. This was on a day when people didn't get divorced. And in their culture, it was the man who could divorce, not the woman. This woman had probably been rejected by 5 different men. Kicked out. The man could take the children with him if he wanted, or he could make her take them. So his choice. And so this is a harsh story, probably, of sexual exploitation. And now to be living with a man that she's not married to. That's commonplace today. Not back then. That was really far out. This woman is really up from the gutter in their way of viewing things. Jesus has brought up to her the single greatest point of pain in her life, and also the clearest evidence that whatever path she's walking isn't working out too well. She must have looked over and just been like, you know, you can imagine the wheels turning. I don't know him. I've never seen him before. I've never seen him in our village. Dude, wait a minute. This guy's a Jew. He doesn't live around here. And probably, you know, within a few seconds, the tumblers would settle and she realizes, oh my God. "Sir," she says, "I see that you're a prophet. This has to be supernatural." And that makes her nervous. She's thinking, oh, so this is not just a man sitting here. This guy is a holy man. This guy knows all about me. Her soul is like a window that he's looking through. Whoa. And so now that she realizes, so this isn't just some crackpot out here talking, this is a prophet of God, she says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim the place we worship is in Jerusalem." Talk about changing the subject. Where does this come from? Why would she say that? This is the perennial theological argument that between Jews and Samaritans, where's the holy place? Is it up here where we built our temple or down where you guys built yours? Why get into this? It should be obvious. This is what you call a red herring across the trail. That's when they would drag a stinky fish across the trail to mislead the dogs that are chasing you, to lead them off in the scent trail. It's an expression that means It's like a smoke screen in the military, in Navy. You lay down smoke and then you make an exit stage left behind the smoke. She is sitting there. She's got a guy telling her her life, the most embarrassing thing about her whole life. And it's getting hot in here, you know. It's like, I want out. And she's like, let's start an argument about religion. That way we can keep things nice and superficial and we won't have to talk about things like my inner need and my lostness and the bankruptcy of my life. Don't want to talk about that. Well, Jesus comes back. He says, girl, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. You Samaritans worship that which you do not know. We worship that which we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. That's a simple affirmation on his part of the Bible, which was hard for the Samaritans to accept, knowing who wrote the Bible. You know, it was a Jewish book. And with the hostility that was there, it was hard for them to accept that. And Jesus is like, no, they're right. It is from God. But he also makes a pretty interesting point here, good point. Neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem, actually. That whole question, sacred space. So we're back to the formalism again. And yet what he's saying here is, and he's making a pretty good point. God created all these mountains, so why would he care which one you're standing on when you pray? And, he also says, yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. It's not in Jerusalem. It's not on the Gerizim. But these are the kind of the worshipers that the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Well, you know, I don't know. I hear that, and I just resonate with it. It makes a lot of sense to me. I've never really understood the attraction of the holy site. You know, we got to take a pilgrimage to whatever so we can get to the holy site. And you know, when you think of an infinite, all-present God, why would a holy site matter? And wouldn't it be true that that getting in with God has nothing to do with where we are, or the way we say it, or anything like that? It has to do with the inner, the inner self. It's the spirit. And it's also truth. To worship God in spirit means that you don't go through outward forms and regulations and rules. It's inward. It's in your spirit that you make contact with God. Your spirit and his spirit. And in truth, too. Which means, we don't get to make up what's true about God. We're not given the authorization to create our own fabricated religion. It's important that I don't worship the God of my creation, but that I worship the God who's actually there, the real God. That's worshiping in truth. Jesus says it's got to be both those things. It's got to be in spirit and it's got to be in truth. Well, again, she's just like, this conversation keeps drifting back in directions I'm not sure I want to go. And she's like, going to try one more way to duck out. She's just like, I know. Listen, when the Messiah comes, who's called the Christ, when he comes, he can explain all this to us. Let's just put it off till then. Well, it ain't going to be that easy. Jesus says, I who speak to you am he. No need to wait any longer for the Messiah. I'm here. Oh, man. What a dramatic moment this must have been. The eyes must have met again. He just told her everything about her life. She realizes he's something to do with God. And then he says this. Suddenly there's a thunk, As her water jar hits the ground, she turns around and runs back up the pathway to the town. Leaving her water jar, the women went back into the town. That's really odd. That's really quite a remarkable thing. This is what she walked. This water jar is a big urn, you know, that you fill up and carry on your shoulder, on your head, with a day's worth of water in it. This is why she came out here. Now she just leaves the water jar and runs back up into the town. It's you can tell that John, who by now John and the other 12 are coming back down, and they see this scene. They see him talking to her and her go running away, and you can see that John was like, "Dude, she left her water pot. It's really odd. This wouldn't happen." Well, it's a statement, as we'll see. We'll talk about that in a minute. She's running back up into town. She starts and says to the people, I would actually agree with the NESB here, says to the men. It was the anthropoi, the men that she spoke to, not the people. Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ? And it's the men who are like, everything? maybe we better go out and see what he knows. Yeah. And they came out of the town and they're making their way down toward him. So, meanwhile, at this point his disciples came and they marveled that he had been speaking with a woman. You can see they have that assumption. You don't do that. Yet no one said, why do you seek or why do you speak with her? Probably being respectful. His disciples urge him, Rabbi, eat something. And we got the burgers. He said to them, I have food to eat you don't know anything about. His disciples are looking at each other. No one gave him anything, did they? My food, said Jesus, is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Yeah. It's a key passage, because what Jesus is saying here is that this event that just transpired, this interchange that I just had, and what's also continuing to happen as these men are filing down the path toward the well, this is the work of God. This is what we call ministry. And ministry is a means of growth. Jesus is watching this whole process, which he anticipated fully. It's clear that he saw this coming. And his spirit is soaring as he sees God's spirit reaching out and drawing people to him, to faith. Jesus says, don't you guys say 4 months more and then comes the harvest? They're like, yeah, that's about right. He says, I tell you, open your eyes and look on the fields that they're already white for harvest. It's hardly any doubt that he's pointing up the path when he says this. The fields that are white unto harvest are these people coming down in their white crops and so forth down that path. Even now, he says, the reaper draws his wages. Even now, he harvests the crop for eternal life so that the sower and the reaper may be glad together. Well, it's a little complicated. I guess Jesus is the sower, right? Because he's been scattering the seed here. Gospel. The reaper be the woman. She's up reaping a harvest here. Thus the saying that one sows and another reaps is true. And so Jesus is basically saying she is going to love what's happened here today, and these guys are going to love it too, and I'm loving it. And he said, I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the hard work, and you've reaped the benefits of their labor. It's a point, you know, they were just up in that town. Wonder how many conversations they got into up there. None. And so he's basically saying, what I'm doing here is what you guys should be doing. And unfortunately, you know, through grace, you're going to get to reap what someone else has done. And me and the woman are doing the job, but you guys are going to get to enter in on the joy of the reaper. And so we read in verse 39 that many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he did stay, and his disciples also stayed there for 2 days. After that, it's because of his words, many more became believers. And they said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know this man really is the Savior of the world." So he must have gone up. There's 2 days more of him preaching, teaching the word up here. Maybe he did some more miracles. That would not be unusual. And there was a great spiritual movement in this town. It's a small town, Sychar, village, really. And yet, many people in that village apparently came to faith, and they were all, this became the buzz. So, what are we seeing? First of all, when she realized, oh my God, it's him, she didn't even think about her water pot. She ran up that hill and left the pot behind. You know, nobody told her she had to do that. Nobody was like, maybe she'd be witnessing more. This is complete spontaneity. That's what that is. I remember when I was a senior in high school, my brother had a contact with a kid in his class who worked at a local radio station. That was like a top 40 station. So they would often get these albums sent to them, promotional albums, and a lot of the more avant-garde, you know, underground type stuff they were not about to play. They would throw those away and they would give them to my brother. And so one day he brought another stack home, and we were getting put into touch with music that from our perspective was, you know, blew away the top 40 stuff. The underground music of the late 60s, and one day they brought home in this album, The Jimi Hendrix Experience. You know what the front of that album cover's like. And we put it on and started listening to it, and you were just like, oh man, never heard anything like this. Nobody knew who he was. And I got that album under my coat. It was raining outside, but I went hiking over to my neighbor's house. And I was like, dude, you got to check this out. This is revolutionary. And we played it and stuff. I put it back in. I went up to another neighbor's house. I went to a third. I went to a fourth. By the time I was done, it was dark outside, still raining, and I came home. You know, and my parents were pissed and wanted to know where I'd been. And, you know, it was like this. I wasn't working for Reprise Records. I wasn't working for Jimi Hendrix. I just felt like, to my friends, you've got to see this. You've got to hear this music. And that's exactly what we see with this woman. When you touch reality, spiritual reality, it's pretty exciting. And meeting Christ is pretty exciting. We can still have this experience today. And when you realize how real Jesus is, when you get that gift of God that he referred to, you can't wait to tell your friends about him. And nobody has to, you know, put you under law to share your faith or anything else. It's just like, dude, come and see this. This is the real thing. This is mind-blowing. Well, in Acts chapter 8, there's an incident recounted. We don't have time to read it, but a persecution broke out up in Jerusalem, and the Christians, by now, Jesus had gone, and the Christian movement was starting, and they got scattered because people were being killed. and they fled all over the place. One of them, a guy named Philip, not the disciple Philip, another one. And it says he went up into a city in Samaria. It could have been the same city. We're not clear on that. But it says that all with one accord in this Samaritan town were giving heed to what he was saying. And it's like the whole town came to faith. And it turned into this big spiritual awakening in that part of the country. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess when you consider this story, and he says that he went up there, and many of the people in this, you know, they're probably up there scratching their head. This is 3 or 4 years later, and they're kind of like, whatever happened to him? We thought he was going to be the Messiah. And all of a sudden, somebody blows in and says, you wouldn't believe it. He rose from the dead, and they believed. They knew that it was true. Yeah, it could have been this city. And it would make sense. And so we have a case where a conversation that Jesus knew was going to happen. That's why he went there. That's why he was at that spot at that time, was to meet this nobody, this rejected person, this woman, Samaritan. Because to his eye, all the outward, you know, rankings and prejudices of man were meaningless, and he knew this was a gal that had the enthusiasm and had the need, and she would respond in faith and spread it all over that town. And that's what happened. Well, so there you have the story of the woman at the well. And next time we're going to go through another story that shows how you can get real faith for yourself if you feel like you're kind of a skeptical, cynical person. How do you overcome that cynicism and skepticism? This story should help you with that.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.